Welcome to this episode of the Event Manager Podcast by Skiff Meetings, the podcast for curious event professionals embracing the future of business events. My name is Emil Nefsch, and I'm the editor-in-chief of Skiff Meetings, and in this episode, we are talking about the evolution of the exhibition industry, including short and long-term trends, with the one and only Kai Hattendorf. Kai is the managing director and CEO of UFI, the global association of the exhibition industry. As such, he's responsible for UFI activities and events globally. He's a journalist by education, and he previously worked at Euronews and the BBC, and also spent a long time in senior leadership roles at Messe Frankfurt. He was recently named the Business Events Strategist of the Year by PCMA and was the honorary president of the Joint Meetings Industry Council, JMIC, from 2019 to 2021. In this conversation about the evolution of the exhibition industry, we talk about the importance of data in telling stories and making business case for trade shows. We talk about the recovery and reopening of China. We talk about moving to a year-round customer engagement rather than standalone exhibitions and trade shows. We talk about how we really move the needle on sustainability around events and trade shows. And Kai shares his thought-provoking vision of the future of trade shows. You don't want to miss that. Hope you enjoy listening to this conversation. I invite you to check out the other episodes of the podcast, which you can find on our website or by subscribing through your favorite podcast service. Greater Phoenix, rising from the Sonoran Desert, has emerged as a premier meetings destination. We earned the Wall Street Journal designation of having a top 10 convention center, as well as the number one airport in the U.S. We've won citywide mega events from the Final Four to SemiCon West. We've cultivated flourishing intellectual capital in the high-tech and biomed sectors. And we've even put a brewery in our convention center. Why? Well, the desert made us do it. Plan your next meeting in Greater Phoenix. Go to visitphoenix.com/meetings. Kai Hattendorf, great to have you on the podcast with us today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Miguel. It's great to be here. And I think I can still say belated Happy New Year.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's valid for almost the whole of January, I think. So Kai Hattendorf, CEO of UFI, would love to get a little short introduction from you about, you know, your first experiences in the business events industry and how you became the CEO of UFI.
Oh, I became the CEO of UFI because I got a call and was asked if I would be interested in becoming the CEO of UFI. And that was in 2015 when I was working at Messe Frankfurt. They actually got me into the exhibition and B2B events industry by asking me to join from the telecommunications industry. And they themselves got me from having worked in a startup, and they themselves got me from having worked in media, because originally I'm a broadcast journalist. So it's, as you see, I'm one of those people who qualified for our industry by doing anything but the events industry.
Perfect. Well, originally I am a sound technician and musician. So yeah, and now I am a journalist in some sense. So I think this is a fun, definitely fun role reversal in some ways. And for anybody who's not familiar with UFI, can you just explain kind of, you know, what the organization is and you know, how the members work, that kind of thing?
Sure. I mean, first of all, we are a global trade association. UFI stands for Union de Froid International, founded in 1925, and we represent the global trade show industry, the organizers and the venues and the major service providers and suppliers. And as the global trade body, we are also the umbrella for close to 70 national and regional associations that are servicing the exhibition sector around the world. So we've grown a global footprint in the last 100 years, representing our sector and working closely with our colleagues all over the world.
Okay. And there's IAEE in the US. Are they competitors? Are they members? How do you have a relationship with them? How does that work? Because I think a lot of our audience may be more familiar with IAEE.
Sure. I mean, IAE was founded a few years after UFI in the US, and they're in many ways doing in North America what UFI does globally. They have some international outreach, mainly through their educational program. We've worked together on a number of issues. We have the more closer relationships in the US to CISO, the Society of Independent Show Organizers, who represent the for-profit show organizer companies. ESCA is an UFI member. We have good relationships with many players in the VMA side, in the Venue Management Association sides.
Yeah.
So we are part of that North American ecosystem. An example for the collaboration there is all of us working together to fund and guide the businesses of the Exhibitions and Conferences Alliance, our joint advocacy office in Washington. That's run by Tommy Goodwin.
Okay, excellent. And just to kind of complete the picture of what UFI is and what it does, I know you do a lot with data as well, and you have access to a lot of data. Could you maybe explain, you know, what data you share with your members, and also things that you share outside, and you know, what kind of numbers you compile?
Yeah, sure. We are the global go-to place for people who are looking for industry data. Twice a year, we are tracking the state of the industry globally in a product that's called the Global Exhibition Industry Barometer. The 30th edition will be out early in February. And there we track the global developments, the KPIs, the profits and revenue developments on a global level, on a regional level, and down to country profiles. So for your US listeners, there's a whole segment on the US, so that you can compare the development of the industry in the US with the development of the industry in North America and globally. You can draw conclusions, how's Asia doing versus the US. You can draw all these comparisons because the data is unified in its metrics. Various other research initiatives and products out, and most of them we make available free of charge on our UFI research portal. So for those who are really into number crunching, ufi.org/research, and you'll find more numbers than I can say on a podcast.
Perfect. But the main piece of research you do, how are people using that? Are they using it to make business decisions, where to invest, that kind of thing?
We have various user groups. First of all, many of our members use it to compare their own development on revenue and profit with the industry in their own market, in international markets. Many use it to prioritize and identify key markets for them to explore and to expand into. We, by now, when we put the data out, there are various research notes from financial institutions covering it for their respective investors. So you see, it's a broad group of people accessing that data. Plus, of course, it also generates a lot of input then again for economic impact studies and for general media awareness on the role and size of our industry.
Yeah, really fascinating. Thanks for sharing that. And we'll definitely be following up on the next barometer, etc. So we're recording this in middle of January 2023, and the big news is, of course, China reopening. I know that this is something, of course, that hopefully the data will show, but not for a little while. And I'm sure that's been a bit of a hole in the data for a little while. What do you know? What can you tell us? What are you hearing from your members that are either in China or investing in China or active in that market?
Well, first of all, let's not forget that in 2021, China was one of the few markets that remained open. So they've been carrying a lot of the burden of keeping our industry going. And many of the international organizers used China as a real generator of revenue back then, which was great. Then they obviously went into a rather muddy situation again for the last couple of months. And now with the reopening, there is a sense of excitement. We ran a webinar with some of our members just before Christmas when the news broke that the opening would come. And I myself was in Hong Kong just a few days before that, discussing plans for the reopening of travel between Hong Kong and the mainland. There's a lot of pent-up demand like we've seen it in all the other markets after the reopening. Right now, we will have to see how the new travel regulations impact Chinese attendance at shows outside of China and when international visitors and exhibitors will return to China in large numbers. As we speak this week, we have the first international shows in Europe with hundreds of Chinese exhibitors. There's Heim Textile taking place in Frankfurt this week, and they have 450, I had a chat with them today, that 450 Chinese exhibitors compared to their usual pre-pandemic 520 or 530, showing the scale to which the Chinese businesses are looking to interact again with their international peers. When it comes to travel into China, tons of invitations reaching us to come over in March, April. There's some sentiment of let's wait and see how the current pandemic wave after the reopening goes. Whereas all the players we were speaking with back in November were hesitant to budget too much revenue and activities in China into their 2023 plannings, there's now increased optimism for sure for the second half of the year and in some respects already for the second quarter. Yeah. And that's, hey, 10 weeks away.
Yeah, pretty interesting. Do you think that the reopening, the pent-up demand, do you think it'll follow a similar pattern to how it's worked in Europe and the US? I mean, the Chinese market is different. I don't know if it's more centralized, but it does seem very much more kind of controlled in some sense. Are you expecting differences, or are you expecting the flow to be quite similar to the kind of Western markets?
I think we can best compare China as a huge internal market to the US as the other huge internal market in the B2B market space globally. And if we look at the rate of recovery across the US as states reopened, those who reopened early were able to recapture almost pre-pandemic levels of business already in 2022. It'll be similar in China with the national demand. The third major market to look at is Europe as a whole, as an integrated market. And you see the similar expectations here. If you look at the 2023 revenue expectations that we have in the barometer, we are somewhere between 80 and 95% for the whole market compared to pre-pandemic levels. And in the UK, for instance, they're optimistic they will grow beyond pre-pandemic already in the first half of this year. So I wouldn't be surprised if China recovers with the same speed. Mm-hmm. And again, then add 5 to 10 to 15% international business to that into China, and you see where we are headed. I think the main issue over the next couple of months to drive the international business into and out of China again will be travel, will be airline capacity, as it was in reconnecting Europe and North America. Let's not forget, it was only in spring last year that the US reopened their borders for international travelers.
Yeah, really interesting. And last question on this, but the pent-up demand, you know, the last I spoke with, we had Ken Holsinger from Freeman on the show recently, and he was talking, we had this number on Skiff Meetings around 65% in kind of spring of last year, which was where we thought kind of shows were in, you know, a general, and Freeman confirmed that number. They came up with the same number. And now he's talking about 84. I know your numbers are slightly different, but you talked about kind of reasonably similar numbers. How certain are you that you know, we'll go back to 2019 levels? One of the things that Ken said was that 2019 was an exceptionally good year, so maybe we shouldn't compare with it. But, you know, just for the sake of having some sort of baseline, do you think the pent-up demand is going to sort of even out and we'll just be kind of, I guess, you know, back at 2019 levels in some way?
Well, this is a pendulum. The pendulum swung all the way over to the digital side because people could not meet. Mm-hmm. And now the movement is swinging to the other side and people are eager to meet, and therefore the revenge tourism and the revenge exhibition attendance and whatever you have it. This is not the new normal. The new normal will be a new baseline and a new balance. There are various trends coming together. I believe the pandemic has fast-tracked that trend away from one global leading event to a series of regional leading events, which means you will have fewer people attending one mega show, but you will have in total way more people attending a number of regional events. So overall, attendance numbers will go way beyond where we were in 2019. The breakdown and the scale of offers will be different, will be more regional, less entirely global in our view. Mm-hmm. And that will open up the B2B events as well as every kind of events to all those people who experienced event brands online during the pandemic, mm-hmm. and are now eager to go and attend it face to face. And so it's the new normal will have seen the pandemic as a catalyst for some trends we saw before that will be fast-tracked in many ways, but it has also opened up a whole new, the next generation of business leaders being eager to actually physically interact face-to-face and not just screen-to-screen.
Yeah, interesting. I had a slightly different interpretation, and if you don't mind, kind of I'll explain my thinking, and then maybe get your reaction. So we're hearing from a lot of corporates that budgets are tight, and they're deciding, you know, which events to go to. I think you've also been hearing a lot from different corporations, and my thinking is, or from what I'm hearing, is sort of the big events, the ones that everybody's at, and you have to be there, they're still investing in. And then you have the smaller events that are more personalized. Maybe they're client events. Maybe they're, you know, places where you can shake hands and really kind of get to know everybody there, or training events, or those kind of things. And then for me, there's sort of a middle ground where there's a lot of events in between that. It's not maybe that everybody's there, but it's an interesting event. And I see those as being a bit more in danger. From what you just said, you're kind of saying that those may be actually benefiting because people may not go to the large ones. Am I reading that correctly?
I think you're right and I'm right. And I think if we combine this both, we find the truth. What you've described is the old retail brand issue. You're either discount or you're luxury. Mm-hmm. And everything that's middle of the road gets squeezed out when things change. We've seen the same in the B2B event space after the 2007, 2008 recession, where the number three or number four trade show servicing sector in the region was suffering and largely disappeared. Mm-hmm. And you had a concentration on the leading brands. It'll be the same this time. I'm entirely agreeing with you. Those Me Too events will struggle. However, the must attend events will change and break down from these globally one in many industries into regional ones. And then you have a regional must attend event where you can send more people because you have a smaller impact on your carbon budget for travel. You have mm-hmm. a smaller impact for your time away from the office or from your screen. And you can open that up to more people. What we see generally is in line with what you've said, is that yes, there are fewer people attending B2B events. They bring the same checkbook, so to say, but mm-hmm. when you had five buyers from a company, you now have three buyers because they no longer bring the two juniors that they are training. If that is something we will see returning, the attendance as part of a training experience or career experience or not, that's another question. But right now, indeed, with budgets tight, there will be fewer people in attendance. They will select more carefully. Mm-hmm. But they have the same impact on the exhibitor as before when it comes to the power, purchasing power.
And sort of to finalize this, are you seeing the opportunity in the larger organizers of these larger trade shows to figure out how they can create regional versions, but sort of under the same brand? Or are you seeing an opportunity for outsiders to jump in and sort of create different shows there?
Oh, both. We will see both, and both will be successful, and there will be failures in both as well. Interestingly, I've had many conversations over the last 6 months where exhibition and event organizers called us as an association asking about our customer touch points. How do you engage your association membership all year round? Because they think we're doing something right in doing that. And they want to learn how they can adapt that to their events portfolio. So what to do in between the events, how to link their regional events with a joint narrative, how to take a storyline from A to B to C, how to evolve the product across the regions to create a better cultural fit, and what to do on screen and digital in between the physical meetings. So this is all the evolution of a business model that was very much centered around a few days in a year with a face-to-face activation towards what some call omnichannel, what some call 365, of a business model of where we as an industry can offer a variety of sales and marketing options to the companies we work with that we call exhibitors to help them to position themselves holistically.
Yep, I think it makes perfect sense.
Are you ready to celebrate your successes in the world of meetings and events? The Skift Meetings Awards are back for 2024, recognizing the most innovative business events companies across 15 categories, and we want you to be a part of it. Winners will feature on Skift Meetings, sending a clear signal to events professionals around the world that these are partners they can rely on. The final deadline for submissions is June 11th. We encourage you to start your submission today to secure the best entry rates. For more information and to start your submission, head to live.skift.com.
It sounds like a lot of these companies have not been able to do that in the past. Why do you think that is? And do you think that they need to change deeply how they work as a company to be able to kind of offer a year-round engagement? Or is this a relatively simple thing if they already do it well for in-person events?
I think they have to go through the same process we have to go through as an industry. We have to change if we produce something like a 365, if we produce omnichannel. We need to add to our focus on in-person event, more data focus, more digital focus. We need to bring in all these skills and the mindset to create these products and services and then to push them out. Likewise, on the customer side, if you take a big company, they've usually built a specialized team on events or even a specialized team around participation at conferences and exhibitions. And these are the specialists that operationally deal with it. And they will probably have to be more integrated in or better linked with the holistic marketing and sales organization. It's ultimately, and as always, it's about overcoming silos and becoming more network-like organizations and structures to deliver on the KPIs for the respective businesses.
It sounds like you've gone through a lot of this process internally and can help your members also do that in some way.
I think we've all done that as associations through the pandemic. And what the pandemic surely taught us is on the events industry association side is collaboration beats competition. And we all have to work together to settle the big issues. And whether you then go and merge associations or buy up smaller players, or whether you have collaboration agreements, there are a million of different ways to get that done. But I think our members rightly respect the best possible support for the association fee that they pay, because ultimately, this is why we exist. So if we don't go through that process, we are frankly not very good at doing our job.
I think very well put. So one of the initiatives that I'd like to talk about briefly is sustainability. You were involved in COP27 with the Race to Zero campaign, I believe, and you've been talking about sustainability for a long time, which I think is great. But I think we all agree we're sort of at the point where we need to have real actions and real kind of next steps. I think a lot of what you did at COP27 was about that. Can you tell us a little bit about kind of where you are and how can we, you know, really talk about in-person exhibitions that, you know, are quite a wasteful activity in many ways, but, you know, there's always ways to improve that. How do we kind of bring sustainability into this in a really effective way?
Yeah. Now we launched together with initially with ICA and AIPC and now hosted and facilitated by JMIC, the Joint Meetings Industry Council. We launched the Net Zero Carbon Events Initiative last year, brought together originally by the colleagues from the ACC, as the UK was hosting COP26 up there in Glasgow. And we united the industry behind a pledge with more than 100 industry players working to formulate that. And as you say, 1 year on in Sharm el-Sheikh at COP27, we didn't just say, what do we want to do? But we answered the question, how were we going? Will we do this by releasing a roadmap for the industry to become net zero carbon by 2050, the latest? Many markets are well advanced and will get there way earlier. Now, this roadmap essentially gives you the what-to-do list. And the work in the initiative, which is by now more than 500 players from the industry collaborating, is about identifying and sharing good practices and best practices on reducing greenhouse gas emissions around events of all types and reducing them by 50% at least by the year of 2030. It all sounds overwhelming and a huge task, but it's so many small steps you can do to get started. So there are documents and how-to guides and the roadmap all available free of charge for everyone on the Net Zero Carbon Events website. And we are working to, we're working 8 parallel work streams on issues like waste reduction, on issues like travel and accommodation, on issues like local food sourcing, but also on transversal issues like measurements and metrics to make sure that we can show that we as the events industry are a part of the solution to the climate crisis, because we build the meeting places and the marketplaces that bring people together to discuss and solve, find solutions, parts of the solutions to solve the issue. Yes, of course, as you said, every event is wasteful in the way that it produces a huge greenhouse gas emissions footprint, and you have to look at the elements of which we can directly influence as an industry. That is everything that happens in the venue. For instance, how we source the energy, how we source the food, whether we use plastics or not. There are parts that are out of our control because they're at the discretion and decision of the participant. How do I travel there? Where do I stay? How do I behave outside of the venue? Now, within the climate conversations, these are known as scope 1, scope 2, and scope 3. And I won't go into the details, but what is needed is a dialogue between us as the events industry, with the hospitality sector, with the travel sector, to see who can fix what. We can build a meeting place or a marketplace where scientists can solve the sustainable aviation fuel issue. But we can't give them a sustainable aviation fuel because, hey, we don't know how to do that, right? So that's their part to solve. And therefore, it's key that we work together. And that's why it's so great that the United Nations is a partner of and backing that Net Zero Carbon Events Initiative. Ultimately, it gives us a seat at the table where the things are debated and decided. And this is where we as an industry have always wanted to be. Now, what does this mean? This is all this kind of big stuff and intergovernment stuff, and it's the advocacy work that happens every day. What do you have from it as the event organizer or as the event attendee? Really, the resources on the website that tell you what you can do today to reduce your greenhouse gas emissions. And likewise, when you have the discussion whether your event, it's good to actually have an event. Mm-hmm. The point that we make is that we aggregate everyone coming together. Just imagine people would meet in smaller groups without a central place to meet, and a major event would not be in one place at one time. But all these connections would be made in individual trips or small group trips. You would have a multitude of flights compared to the ones that are taking place this way. And so we are validly making the point that events are a huge aggregator of carbon emissions, but that also allows us to concentrate on diminishing them in one place rather than having carbon emissions popping up decentralized all over. And ultimately, and we are working on some numbers there, there is a factor multiplier to which it is more efficient and better for the planet if we have a proper meeting with everyone in one place.
Sure. I think you said something interesting about the travel and I guess not, collaborating with other industries and other people trying to solve those issues. And travel, as far as I'm aware, is the biggest, especially air travel and long haul travel, is the biggest contributor to kind of greenhouse emissions. But in a sense, the industry also promotes that long haul travel. How do you balance that out? Because it's, I can see it's relatively easy to say, hey, that's somebody else's problem. But ultimately, if you're creating an event that attracts and by default, wants people to travel long haul, you are also promoting that thing which is the most pollutant in many ways. How can you balance that out, or how can you come up with a compromise that kind of makes sense?
Well, that goes directly back to what we were discussing before, the regionalization of events, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are events where you want to have people from all over the world to come together. And if you look at the politicians level, this is why the COP conference is the COP conference, with everyone coming together from all over the world for the big climate conference. Mm-hmm. Or take a G20 summit. I was just in India when India was hosting the first meetings, having taken over the presidency of the G20 last month. When it matters, people meet. And where that needs to happen on a global scale, people will travel the world to do so. But the way businesses will evolve and the way exactly this conversation that you and I are having now will evolve will be yet another driver for a regionalization of events that don't need to have predominantly a global audience united in one place, but can also be a number of regional audiences coming together.
Yeah, so there's definitely different sort of solutions and sustainability needs to be a part of that consideration for
finding. Yeah, and if you then take Europe, for instance, many of the places in Europe can by now be reached with other means of transport than just planes in a way that is acceptable as the train networks are getting better or events are becoming more regionalized. So it is a part of the discussion, and it will impact the way events evolve and the prioritization of events and the scaling of events evolves. And part of the answer will indeed be a regionalization.
Okay. Interesting. Thank you. Thank you for clarifying and kind of expanding on that answer. So I know you recently released 5 trends, which I think a lot of different publications talk about trends at this time of the year. And I think it's always interesting to kind of predict the future. I don't want to go into all the details, but what do you think from the trends that you're predicting? One of them is around sustainability, but from the other ones, what do you think is going to have the biggest impact this year in terms of how business is done, particularly in the exhibition sector?
Mm-hmm. I think the last year was all about the trade and trade show and reconnecting people to come to the floor, come back to the floor, and they were eager to. Now that this is done, and we were already discussing that this is not the new normal yet, with having in mind that we are facing inflationary pressures unseen in most of the mature economies in at least your lifetime and mine, and facing recessions, we need to be super focused on the needs of the customer. In everything we produce and every event we do, we need to think first and foremost, how does this help our customers to be successful? How does it earn them the money back that they invest and more? If we do this right, the rest will follow, and we will manage through this recession and through this inflation. And luckily, inflation rates are already coming down again. We will manage through this well, as we've seen in 2007, 2008, when we had the last recession. And as we see in markets of high inflation that are doing well despite that challenge. So the absolute key is to know what your customers want, expect, and need, and to help them see how you help them get it.
Mm-hmm. So really that customer service, that customer approach, a lot also what you're talking about, the kind of year-round connection, that seems to be part of that as well, right? It's not just a once people show up, we'll kind of take care of them, but actually kind of handholding all throughout the year.
Yeah, and that's where the, I think where the discussion about what really is the digitization of our industry comes in. I am known to be outspoken on virtual events. They are an eternal business case zombie in my view. They just don't fly. I don't believe in the metaverse. early on when I joined Massive Frankfurt, there was the hype around Second Life, and we were discussing whether we need to rebuild the venue in Second Life, and we did not, because we went to the IBM conference center that they had set up there and saw some rather questionably looking avatars talking football and business. So I don't believe in the virtual worlds, but there's a lot of technology and a lot of data, and we've gracefully learned a lot about it in the pandemic, and how we can use data to improve the customer experience and how to build more digital products and services around the physical events and between the physical events. So we call that more data, less hype. It's not about throwing a big catchphrase out there like hybrid or metaverse, but it's really about the applications that are not that sexy, but that all make a big difference, again, in the customer experience.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I like to talk about invisible technology, which is, you know, really the idea that if the technology is working really well, you shouldn't really notice it's there almost. And I think examples of that are just like, you know, QR code check-ins when you arrive at an exhibition or something like that, which seem so obvious now. But I think the pandemic really accelerated in many senses a lot of these technologies, a lot of kind of implementations.
Yeah, you're right. And what was a weird thing 4 years ago now is a standard that you just use on your way to the show floor.
Exactly. It just feels like everybody's expecting it to be there. In terms of
I have to say though, I miss my good old show catalogs. You know, in the old days when I went to trade shows as a reporter, and I went to CeBIT in 2000, and I got this kind of 2 kilos of exhibitor book. I used that for weightlifting in my hotel room. So in some ways, we all have a reason to miss some of the haptic things we had in the past. But to have all the exhibitor data in an app, for instance, has become such an invisible technology, like you just described, and nobody questions it anymore.
Yeah. I'm not a big fan of big, heavy pieces of paper, but I think when you're on site, there is something about just having it there very quickly that makes sense. I don't know, you know, then taking it home and it eventually going in the bin, you know, 5 years later is probably not the best use of, you know, that much paper and printing, etc.
No, but you clean out your office and you find all the old ones. Let's just say when I left Messe Frankfurt, I gave a lot of things to the company archive, and I said, oh, okay, fine. Yes.
That's where that was. Okay. Kai, fascinating chatting with you. Just wanted to ask you kind of a final kind of wrap-up question in a sense. Do you have a clear vision of what a business trade show will look like in, let's say, 5-10 years time? And I guess what I'm most interested in is the differences. What do you see will be, what do you think will be different at that point?
It will still be a show floor. The show floor will probably be less about presenting products and more about facilitating conversation. I don't know if that's a conference stage or whether this is a company's having their booth redesigned in a way that it is not just reusable, but also conversation driven. There will be products on display where you have tangible products, because nothing beats seeing them, feeling them, touching them. But it'll be a way more communication driven floor. You will have, again, probably a more intimate experience, not 500,000 square meters of a world leading show floor somewhere once a year. You will probably be connected through your Apple goggles or whatever they will release over the next couple of weeks. So one piece of disruptive technology that you and I don't know about yet. Mm-hmm. That will change the digital experience in a way that becomes more holistic. And you can probably be better connected to your back office in many, many ways. It will have an element of augmentation that adds a different layer, an additional layer of services, values, experiences. But it will remain driven by people wanting to spend time with other people.
Yeah, really interesting. So I guess in your vision, the AR goggles or whatever they will be sort of replace the phone in a way, become a more intuitive way of connecting with the office or with work and maybe getting information from exhibitors or matchmaking or something like that. Is that sort of how you see it?
I think we're probably at the end of the evolution of what you can do with a pocket computer that is driven by a big screen, i.e. an iPhone or a smartphone. And I wouldn't be surprised if we have a new bit of tech that will evolve or replace that pocket screen and drive parts of the experience. To what level that is kind of, if that's goggles or if that is haptic, I have no idea. Ask Cupertino. they will show something, and it will not be a game changer. But a piece of tech that will allow us to have a better service, customer experience, better business done, will drive the value of the event onwards and upwards.
Absolutely. I think that's a really interesting and clear vision. So thank you for sharing that with us. So the only thing I have left to ask you is if you can recommend someone that we can continue these conversations with, or someone else who'd be a good guest on the Event Manager podcast.
Well, thanks for giving me a short heads up on that, so I could actually think about this. I think with that emphasis on customer focus, it would be worth hearing the customer's perspective. And we had a great speaker back in June at our Global CEO Summit in Hamburg from Siemens, in charge of the events, Stephen Rose. And I think he would be a fantastic voice for your podcast to add the perspective of a global business entity like Siemens and what they use events for and what their expectations are and also what they foresee coming, both on sustainability and on the ultimately the way they want participation events to help them drive their bottom line.
Perfect. I think that's an excellent recommendation. And we always love to hear from the client side and, you know, what they're looking at, what trends are they following, et cetera, I think is always really fascinating. So greatly appreciate that. Kai, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure. Wish you lots of luck with all of the UFI activities. Looking forward to seeing the barometer soon. And I'm sure we'll be in touch.
Thank you, Miguel. And looking forward to chatting next time.
Perfect.